Will it be so terrible that after all these years, you and I finally will have a few days and nights of being able to talk to each other without disasters or small boys interrupting us?
It would be good, I conceded. And just that simply, my mood lifted, and our homeward journey together began. I had never traveled in such indulgence. I had brought few supplies, thinking I would live rough on the way home. Nettle was likewise traveling light, save for a wallet full of silvers. The first time I proposed that if we were going to camp for the night, we should begin to look for a likely place, she stood up in her stirrups, looked all around, and then pointed to smoke rising.
That's a house at the least, and more likely a village with an inn, however humble. And that is where I intend to stop tonight, and if there is a hot bath to be had, it will be mine, and a good meal.
And she was right. There were all three of those things, in fact, and she put silver out for me as well as herself, saying,
Shade told me not to let you do anything to punish yourself for being sad.
For a few quiet moments, I handled her words, trying to see if they truly applied to me. They didn't, I was sure, but I could think of no defense. She cleared her throat.
Let's talk about Hap, shall we? Did you know that there is rumor that despite being a minstrel, and a wandering one at that, he has a sweetheart at Darrett Keep, and he is true to her? She is a weaver in the town there.
I had not known that, or much of the other gossip she shared with me. That evening, although there were several other minor nobles occupying the same inn, Nettle kept company with me, and we remained long by the hearth fire in the central room after the others had sought their beds. From her, I learned that Buckkeep politics were as tangled and the intimate royal gossip as thorny as ever. She had quarrelled with King Dutiful, for she feared for the safety of the adolescent princes, too often off to the Out Islands with their mother. He had dared to tell her it was none of her business, and she had replied that if it was his business that she could not wed, because he consistently exposed his heirs to danger, then she had a right to add her thoughts on it. Queen Eliania had recently suffered a miscarriage. It had been a girl child, the child she had dreamed of. It was a terrible loss, as well as a bad omen to her mother's house. When they had departed so hastily for Buckkeep, it was so that Eliania could take the princes for yet another long visit to her homeland. Some of the dukes had begun to grumble about how often the lads were away. King Dutiful was caught between his dukes and his queen, and seemed able to find no compromise. When I asked after Riddle, Nettle said he was well the last time she had seen him, and then decisively steered our conversation away from that. She seemed to have given up all hope of ever gaining King Dutiful's permission to wed, and yet I had never seen her evince interest in another man. I longed to know what was in her heart, and wished she were more inclined to confide in me as she once had in her mother. Instead, she turned our talk to other problems brewing along our border. Dragons were ranging over Chalced, preying where they pleased, and they had begun sometimes to cross the border and ravage the herds of Shokes and even Farrow. The six duchies' folk expected the skill coterie of the king to turn back the dragons, or at least negotiate with them. But the concepts of diplomacy and compromise were laughable to dragons, if dragons laughed, which both Nettle and I doubted. We pondered if one could negotiate with dragons, and what the repercussions would be of slaying a dragon, and if paying tribute to dragons with slaughter herds was cowardly or simply pragmatic. Some of her news was not political, but of family. Swift and Webb had recently visited Buckkeep. Swift's bird partner was healthy and strong, but Webb's gull was so poorly that Webb had taken a room in Buckkeep town that overlooks the water. The bird mostly lived on his windowsill. He fed her, for she flew little now. The end was coming, and they were both awaiting it. While Nettle herself was not witted, through me and her brother Swift, she understood what it was to lose a wit partner. But it was not only gossip we shared. We talked of food and music we enjoyed, and which old tales were our favourites. She told me stories of her childhood, mostly of the mischief she and her brothers had perpetrated. In turn, I spoke of my days as a boy in Buckkeep, and how different both castle and town had been then. Burrick figured much in all our tales. On our last evening together, Before we left the river road to follow the narrower road that led to Withy Woods, she asked me about Lord Golden. Had he truly once been a jester for King Shrewd? Yes, he had. And he and I had been very close?
Nettle, I said as she rode looking straight ahead.
I waited until she turned to look at me. Her tanned cheeks were a bit more flushed than usual. I loved that man as I have loved no one else. I do not say I loved him more than I love your mother, but that the way I loved him was different. If you have heard there was anything improper in our bond, there was not. That was not what we were to each other. What we had went beyond that. She did not meet my eyes, but she nodded.
And what became of him? She asked in a softer voice.
I do not know. He left Buckkeep while I was still lost in the stones. I never heard from him again. I think my voice told her far more than my words did.
I am so sorry, Dar, she said quietly.
Did she know that it was the first time she had honored me with that title? I held a very careful silence, savoring the moment. And then we crested a slight rise, and the village of Withy was before us, cupped in a gentle valley beside a river, and I knew we would reach Withy Woods before the afternoon was old. I found I suddenly regretted how soon our journey together must end. Even more, I dreaded what she would think of her mother and how far her delusions had carried her away from us. And yet the visit began well. When we arrived, Molly hugged me warmly and then turned delightedly to her eldest child. She had not expected me to return so soon and had not expected to see Nettle at all. We had arrived shortly after noon and were both ravenous. All three of us retired to the kitchen where we merrily dismayed the household staff by insisting on raiding the pantry for a simple feast of bread, cheese, sausage and ale instead of waiting for them to prepare something more elaborate for us. When Cook Nutmeg put her foot down and chased us out of her kitchen, we picnicked at one end of the great dining table. We told Molly all about our journey, the simple but moving ceremonies that had preceded the king's internment, and Ketrican's decision to stay for a time in the mountains. And as there is from any journey, no matter how solemn the destination, there were humorous stories to tell that set us all laughing. Molly had stories of her own to share with us. Some goats had managed to get into the vineyards and had done damage to some of the oldest vines there. They would recover, but most of this year's grapes from that section of the vineyard were lost. We'd had several major incursions of wild pigs into the hayfield. The major damage they did was trampling the hay to where it was almost impossible to harvest it. Lozen from the village had brought his dogs and gone after them. He'd killed one big boar, but one of his dogs had been badly ripped in the process. I sighed to myself. I was sure that would be one of the first problems I'd have to tackle. I'd never enjoyed boar hunts, but it would be necessary now. And Tallman would once again renew his plea for hounds of our own. And somehow, while I was silently wool-gathering on boars and dogs and hunting, the topic changed, and then Molly was tugging at my sleeve and asking me, "Don't you want to see what we've done?" "Of course," I replied, and arose from the pitiful remains of our haphazard meal to follow my wife and my daughter. My heart sank when I realized she was leading us to her nursery. Nettle glanced back at me over her shoulder, but I kept my expression bland. Nettle had not seen the room since Molly had taken it over, and when she opened the door, I realized I hadn't either. The room had originally been a parlor intended for greeting important guests. In my absence, it had become a carefully appointed nursery, rich with every luxury that a gravid woman could wish for her child to come. The cradle in the center of it was of fine mellow oak, cunningly fashioned so that if one stepped on a lever, it would gently rock the child. A carved farseer buck watched over the head of the cradle. I believe Lady Patience had had it built in her early days at Withy Woods, when she still hoped to conceive a child. It had waited, empty, for decades. Now the cradle was heaped with soft bedding and netted with lace so that no insect might sting the occupant. The low couch now boasted fat cushions where a mother might recline to feed her child, and there were thick rugs underfoot. The deep windows looked out onto a garden cloaked in the first fall of autumn leaves. The thick glass was curtained first with lace, and then translucent silk, and finally with a tightly woven curtain that would keep out both bright sunlight and cold. There was a painted glass enclosure Molly could put around the lamp to dim its light as well. Behind a fanciful screen of flowers and bees wrought in iron, the low fire danced for her in the large hearth. She smiled at our amazement.
"Isn't it lovely?"
she asked quietly.
"It's beautiful. Such a peaceful room,"
Nettle managed to say. I tried to find my tongue. I'd been holding Molly's fancy at a distance. Now I had stepped into her delusion. The stupid wanting that I thought I had smothered roared up like a fire through charred twigs. A baby. How sweet would it have been to have our own little baby here, where I could watch him grow, where I could see Molly be mother to our child. I feigned a cough and rubbed my face. I walked to the lamp and examined the painted flowers on the screen with a scrutiny they didn't merit. Molly went on talking to Nettle.
"When Patience was alive, she showed me this cradle. It was up in the attic. She'd had it made in the years when she and Chivalry lived here, when she dreamed it was still possible she might conceive. All those years it has waited. It was far too heavy for me to move by myself, but I called Revel and showed it to him. And he had it carried down here for me, and once the wood was polished, it was such a lovely thing that we decided we really needed to make the whole room as fine a nursery as the cradle deserved. Oh, and come here, just look at these trunks. Revel found them in a different attic, but isn't it wonderful how close a match the wood is? He thought that perhaps the oak was grown right here at Withywoods, which could explain why the colour is so close to the cradle. This one has blankets, some of wool for winter months and some lighter for the spring. And this entire trunk, I'm shocked to say, is all clothing for the baby. I had not realized how much I'd actually sewn for him until Revel suggested we put it all in one place. There are different sizes, of course. I wasn't as foolish as that, as to make all the little gowns for a newborn."
And on. The words poured out of Molly, as if she had longed for months to be able to speak openly about her hopes for her child. And Nettle looked at her mother and smiled and nodded. They sat on the couch and took clothing from the trunk and laid it out to look at it. I stood and watched them. I think that for a moment, Nettle was caught in her mother's dream. Or perhaps, I thought to myself, it was the same longing they shared. Molly for a child she was long past bearing, and Nettle for a child she was forbidden to bear. I saw Nettle take up a little gown and lay it across her breast as she exclaimed,
"So tiny! I had forgotten how small babies were. It has been years since Hearth was born."
Oh, Hearth! He was almost the biggest of my babies. Only Just was larger. The things I made for Hearth he outgrew within a few months.
"I remember that!"
Nettle exclaimed.
"His little feet hung out the bottoms of his gown, and we'd cover him, only to have him kick all his blankets off a moment later."
Purest envy choked me. They were gone, both of them, back to a time when I hadn't existed in either of their lives, back to a cozy, noisy home full of children. I did not begrudge Molly her years of marriage to Burrick. He had been a good man for her. But this was like a slow knife turning in me, to watch them recollect an experience I would never have. I stared at them, the outsider, again. And then, as if a curtain had lifted or a door opened, I realized that I excluded myself. I went over and sat down beside them. Molly lifted a tiny pair of knit boots from the chest. She smiled and offered them to me. Without a word, I took them. They scarcely filled the palm of my hand. I tried to imagine the tiny foot that would go into one, and could not. I looked over at Molly. There were lines at the corners of her eyes and lines framing her mouth. Her rosy full lips had faded to pale pink arcs. I suddenly saw her not as Molly, but as a woman of some 50-odd years. Her lush dark hair had thinned and grey streaked it, but she looked at me with such hope and love, her head turned just slightly to one side. and I saw something else in her eyes, something that had not been there 10 years ago. Confidence in my love. The wariness that had tinged our relationship was gone, worn to nothing by our last decade together. She finally knew that I loved her, that I would always put her first. I had finally earned her trust. I looked down at the little booties in my hand and slipped my 2 fingers inside them. I stood them up on my palm. I danced them a couple of steps on my hand. She reached to still my fingers and slid the soft grey boots away. "Soon enough," she told me, and leaned against me. Nettle looked up at me, and such gratitude shone in her eyes that I felt I had suddenly won a battle I had not even known I was fighting. I cleared my throat and managed to speak without huskiness. "I want a hot cup of tea," I told them, and Molly sat up, exclaiming, "You know, that would be exactly what I want right now myself." And despite our weariness from travel, the afternoon passed pleasantly. Much later that night, we shared a dinner that met cook nutmeg standards and a jot of brandy that exceeded mine. We had retired to the estate study, where Nettle had refused to look at my careful bookkeeping, saying she was certain all was well. Nettle had insisted she must leave in the morning. Molly had tried to dissuade her, to no avail. I was nearly dozing in a chair by the fire when Nettle spoke softly from her corner of a settee. "Seeing it is much worse than hearing about it." She sighed heavily. "It's real. We are losing her." I opened my eyes. Molly had left us, saying she wished to see if there was any of that pale sharp cheese left in the larder, as she suddenly fancied it. She put her desire for it down to her pregnancy, and, Molly-like, had disdained the idea of ringing for a servant at such a late hour. She was beloved by our servants simply because she spared them from such thoughtless abuse. I looked at the place where Molly had been sitting. The imprint of her body was still on the cushions, and her scent lingered in the air. I spoke softly. "She's slowly sliding away from me. Today was not too bad. There are days when she is so focused on this baby that she speaks of nothing else." "She makes it seem so real," Nettle said, her words faltering away between wistfulness and dread. "I know. It's hard. I've tried to tell her it's impossible, and when I do, I feel like I'm being cruel. But today, playing along, that feels crueler now, as if I've given up on her." I stared at the dying fire. "I've had to ask the maidservants to indulge her. I'd seen them rolling their eyes after she'd passed by. I rebuked them for it, but I think it only..." Angry sparks sprang in Nettle's eyes. She sat up straight. "I don't care if my mother is as mad as a hatter. They must be made to treat her with respect. You can't indulge them in any smirking tolerance. She is my mother and your wife, Lady Molly." "I'm not sure how to deal with it without making it worse," I confided to her. "Molly has always taken care of the running of the household. If I step in and start disciplining the servants, she may resent me usurping her authority. And what can I say to them? We both know your mother's not pregnant. How long must I order them to maintain this pretense? Where does it end? With the birth of an imaginary child?" Nettle's face went pale at my words. For a moment, the planes of her face were white and stark, like the frozen flanks of a mountain under snow. Then she abruptly dropped her face into her hands. I looked at the pale parting in her gleaming dark hair. She spoke through her fingers. "We're losing her. It's only going to get worse. We know that. What will you do when she no longer knows you? When she cannot take care of herself anymore? What will become of her?" She lifted her face. Silent tears gleamed in streaks down her cheeks. I crossed the room and took her hand. "I promise this. I will take care of her. Always. I will love her. Always." I steeled my will. "And I will speak to the servants privately and tell them that regardless of how long they have worked here, if they value their positions, they will treat Lady Molly as befits the mistress of this household. no matter what they may think of her requests. Nettles sniffed and drew her hands free of mine to wipe the backs of her wrists across her eyes. I know I'm not a child anymore, but just the thought of losing her... She let her words trail away, her voice stilling before she uttered the words we both knew welled up in her. She still mourned Burrick, the only real father she'd ever known. She did not want to lose her mother as well, and even worse would be to have Molly look at her and not know her. I'll take care of her, I promised again. And you, I thought to myself, and wondered if she would ever let me step into that role. Even if it means pretending for her that I believe she has a child growing inside her. Though it makes me feel false to her when I do so. Today, I faltered, guilt welling up in me. I had behaved as if Molly were truly pregnant, indulging her as if she were a fanciful child, or a madwoman. You were being kind, Nettles said quietly. I know my mother. You won't convince her to give up this delusion. Her mind is unsettled. You may as well be... Molly set down the tray with a solid clack on the table. We both jumped guiltily. Molly stared at me, her eyes black. She folded her lips tightly, and at first, I thought she would yet again ignore our disagreement. But Nettle was right. She stood her ground and spoke plainly. You both think me mad? Well, this is fine then, but I will tell you plainly that I feel the child move within me, and my breasts have begun to swell with milk. The time is not far when you will both have to beg my pardon. Nettle and I, caught in our secret worrying, sat dumbstruck. Nettle had no reply for her mother, and Molly turned and stalked from the room. We looked at each other guilt-stricken, but neither of us went after her. We soon sought our beds. I had looked forward on my ride home to a sweet reunion with my wife and a shared night. Instead, Molly had sought out the couch in her nursery. I went alone to our bedchamber, and it seemed a cold and empty place. The very next day, Nettle left before noon to return to Buckkeep Castle. She said she had been long away from her skill apprentices, and that there would be all sorts of neglected work awaiting her. I didn't doubt her, but neither did I believe that was her prime reason for leaving. Molly hugged her farewell, and a stranger might have thought all was well between mother and daughter. But Molly had not mentioned the baby since she had left us the evening before, nor asked if Nettle would return for the birth. And in the days that followed, she no longer spoke of her phantom child to me. We ate breakfast together. We spoke of the matters of the estate, and over dinner shared the events of our days, and each of us slept alone, or in my case, did not sleep. I did more translation work for Shade in the late night hours than I had in the previous 6 months. 10 days after the incident, one late evening, I made bold to seek her in her nursery. The door was closed. I stood before it for several long moments, before deciding that I should knock rather than walk in. I tapped, waited, and then knocked more loudly. "Who is it?" Molly's voice sounded surprised. "It's me." I opened the door a crack. "May I come in?" "I never said you couldn't," she replied tartly. The words stung, and yet a smile tugged at my face. I turned slightly away from her, lest she see it. Now there was the Molly red skirts I knew. "That's true," I said quietly. "But I know that I hurt your feelings badly, and if you wanted to avoid me for a time, I thought I should not intrude." "Not intrude," she said quietly. "Fitz, are you certain you are not the one who has been avoiding me? For how many years have I wakened at night to find your side of the bed cool and empty, slipping out of our bed in the dead of night to hide away in your dusty little scroll hole, scribbling until your fingers are all ink?" I bowed my head to that. I had not realized she was aware of those times. I had been tempted to point out that she had left our bed for this nursery. I put that barb down. It was not time to begin a battle. I was inside her door now, and felt like the wolf the first time he had ventured inside a house. I wasn't sure where I should stand or if I could sit. She sighed and sat up on the divan where she'd been reclining. She was in her nightrobe, but she moved a half-finished bit of embroidery to make room for me. I suppose I do spend too many hours there, I apologized. I sat down beside her. Her scent reached me, and I suddenly said, "Whenever I smell you, I always want to kiss you." She stared at me in astonishment, laughed, and then said sadly, "Of late, I wondered if you even wanted to be near me at all anymore. Old and wrinkly, and now you think me mad." I gathered her close before she could say more. I kissed her, the top of her head, the side of her face, and then her mouth. "I will always want to kiss you," I said into her hair. "You don't believe I'm pregnant?" I didn't let go of her. "You've been telling me for over 2 years that you are pregnant. What am I to think, Molly?" "I don't understand it myself," she said. "But all I can tell you is that I must have somehow been mistaken at first. I must have thought I was pregnant before I was. Perhaps I knew, somehow, that I was going to be pregnant." She leaned her brow on my shoulder. "It has been hard for me to have you gone for days at a time. I know that the maidservants giggle about me behind their hands. They know so little of us. They think it's scandalous for a man as young and hale as you to be married to an old woman like me. They gossip that you married me for my money and position. They make me feel an old fool. Who do I have who understands who we are and what we have been to each other? Only you. And when you abandon me, when you think me as foolish as they do, then, oh, Fitz, I know it's hard for you to believe it, but I have believed much harder things for your sake and with only your word to go on." I felt as if the whole world went still around me. Yes, she had. I'd never stopped to see it from that perspective. I bent my head and kissed her salt-tear cheek. "You have." I took a breath. "I will believe you, Molly." She choked on a laugh. "Oh, Fitz, please, no you won't. But I'm going to ask you to pretend that you do. Only when we're in here together. And in return, when I am not in this room, I will pretend I am not pregnant, as best I can." She shook her head, her hair rubbing against my cheek. "I am sure that will be much easier for the servants, except for Revel. Our steward seemed absolutely delighted to help me construct this nest." I thought of Revel, tall, almost gaunt in his thinness, always grave and correct with me. Was he? It didn't seem believable. "Oh, yes, he found the screens with the pansies on them and had them cleaned before he even told me. I came in here one day and they were set up around the cradle and the lace over it to keep insects away." Pansies. From patience, I knew they were sometimes called heart's ease. I owed Revel. She stood, pulling herself out of my arms. She stepped away from me, and I looked at her. Her long nightgown was scarcely revealing, and she had always been a woman of curves. She went to the hearth, and I saw that there was a tray set on a stand with tea things on it. I studied her profile. She looked a little different to me than she had 5 years ago. Surely, if she were pregnant, I'd be able to tell. I measured the slight swell of her belly, her ample hips and generous breasts, and suddenly, I was not thinking of babies at all. She glanced over at me, asking, teapot in hand, "Would you like some?" Then, as I stared at her, her eyes slowly widened and a wicked smile curved her mouth. It was a smile worthy of a naked girl wearing only a holly crown. "Oh, indeed I would," I replied. As I rose and went to her, she came to meet me. We were gentle and slow with each other. And that night, we both slept in her bed in the nursery. Winter found Withywoods the next day, with a fall of wet snow that brought down the remaining leaves on the birches and lined their graceful branches with white. The stillness that the first snowfall always brings settled like a mantle over the land. Within Withywood's manor, it suddenly seemed a time for wood fires and hot soup and fresh bread at noon. I had returned to the manor's study, and a clear flamed fire of applewood was crackling on the hearth when there was a tap at the door. "Yes," I called, looking up from a missive from Webb. The door opened slowly, and Revel entered. His fitted coat hugged his wide shoulders and narrow waist. He was always impeccably attired and correct in his manners. Decades younger than me, he had a bearing that made me feel like a boy with dirty hands and a stained tunic when he looked down at me. "You sent for me, Holder Badgerlock?" "I did." I set Webb's letter to one side. "I wanted to speak to you about Lady Molly's chamber. The screens with the pansies on them..." The expectation of my disapproval flickered in his eyes. He drew himself up to his full height and looked down on me with the dignity that a truly good house steward always radiates.
"Sir, if you please, the screens have not seen use in decades, and yet they are lovely things worthy of display. I know I acted without direct authorization, but Lady Molly has seemed, dispirited of late. Before you departed, you had directed me to see to her needs. I did. As for the cradle, I came upon her sitting at the top of the stairs, all out of breath and near weeping. It is a heavy cradle, sir, and yet she had managed to move it that far on her own. I felt shamed that she had not come to me and simply told me what she wished me to do. And so, with the screens, I tried to anticipate what she would wish. She has always been kind to me." He stopped talking. Plainly he felt there was much more he could have said to someone as thick-witted and rock-hearted as I apparently was. I met his gaze and then spoke quietly. "As she has to me. I am grateful for your service to her and to the estate. Thank you." I had called him in to tell him that I had decided to double his wages. While the gesture still seemed correct, speaking aloud of it suddenly seemed a mercenary thing to do. He had not done this for money. He had repaid a kindness with a kindness. He would discover our largesse when he received his month's wages, and he would know what it was for. But money was not what would matter to this man. I spoke quietly. "You're an excellent steward, Revel, and we value you highly. I want to be sure you know that." He inclined his head slightly. It wasn't a bow. It was an acceptance. "I do now, sir."
"Thank you, Revel."
"I'm sure you're welcome, sir."
And he left the room as quietly as he'd come. Winter deepened around Withywoods. The days shortened, the snow piled up, and the nights were black and frosty. Molly and I had made our truce and we both kept it. It made life simpler for both of us. I truly think peace was what we most desired. Most early evenings I spent in the room I had come to think of as Molly's study. She tended to fall asleep there, and I would cover her well, and then creep away to my own disorderly den and my work there. So it was very late one night, as we were drawing close to midwinter. Shade had sent me a very intriguing set of scrolls, in a language that was almost out-Islander. There were three illustrations in them, and they seemed to be of standing stones, with small notations at the side that could have been glyphs. This was the sort of puzzle that I dreaded, for I did not have enough clues to solve it, and yet I could not leave it alone. I was working on the scrolls, creating a page beside the first one that duplicated the faded illustrations, substituting the words I could translate and leaving room for the others. I was trying to gain a general idea of what the scroll was about, but was totally mystified by the apparent use of the word porridge in its title. It was late, and I believed myself the only one awake in the house. Wet snow was falling thickly outside, and I had closed the dusty curtains against the night. When the wind blew, the snow splattered against the glass. I was half wondering if we'd be snowed in by morning, and if the wet snow would put an ice glaze on the grapevines. I looked up abruptly. My wit sense stirred, and a moment later the door eased open. Molly peered around. "What is it?" I asked, sudden anxiety making my query sharper than I intended. I could not recall the last time she had sought me out in my study. She clutched at the doorframe. For an instant she was quiet, and I feared I had injured her feelings. Then she spoke through a held breath. "I'm here to break my word."
"What?"
"I can't pretend I'm not pregnant anymore. Fitz, I'm in labor. The baby will come tonight." A faint smile framed her gritted teeth. An instant later, she took a sudden deep breath. I stared at her. "I'm certain," she replied to my unasked question. "I felt the first pangs hours ago. I've waited until they were strong and closer together to be sure. The baby is coming, Fitz."
She waited. "Could it be bad food?" I asked her. The sauce on the mutton at dinner seemed very spicy to me, and perhaps...
"I'm not sick, and I didn't eat dinner, not that you noticed. I'm in labor. Ida, bless us all. Fitz, I've had 7 children that were born alive and 2 miscarriages in my life. Don't you think I know what I'm feeling now?"
I stood slowly. There was a faint sheen of sweat on her face. A fever leading her delusion to deepen? "I'll send for Tavia. She can go for the healer while I help lie you down."
"No."
She spoke the word bluntly.
"I'm not sick, so I don't need a healer, and the midwife won't come. She and Tavia think me just as daft as you do."
She took a breath and held it. She closed her eyes, folded her lips, and her grip on the door's edge grew white-knuckled. After a long moment, she spoke.
"I can do this alone. Burrick always helped me with my other births, but I can do this alone if I must."
Did she mean that to sting as much as it did?
"Let me help you to your nursery," I said.
I half expected her to swat at me as I took her arm, but instead, she leaned on me heavily. We walked slowly through the darkened halls, pausing 3 times, and I thought I might have to carry her. Something was deeply wrong with her. The wolf in me, so long dormant, was alarmed at her scent.
"Have you vomited?"
I asked her.
"And do you have a fever?"
She didn't answer either question. It took forever to reach her chamber. Inside, a fire burned on the hearth. It was almost too warm in the room. When she sat down on the low couch and groaned with the cramp that took her, I said quietly,
"I can bring you a tea that would purge you. I really think..." "I labor to bring forth your child. If you won't be any help, then leave me,"
she told me savagely. I couldn't stand it. I rose from my seat beside her, turned, and walked as far as the door. There I halted. I will never know why. Perhaps I felt that joining her in madness would be better than letting her go there alone. Or perhaps that joining her would be better than remaining in a rational world without her. I changed my voice, letting my love rule it.
"Molly, tell me what you need. I've never done this. What should I bring? What should I do? Should I call some of the women to attend you?"
Her muscles were tight when I asked. It was a moment before she answered.
"No, I want none of them. They would only titter and simper at the foolish old woman. So only you would I have here. If you can find the will to believe me, at least within this room, Fitz, keep your word to me. Pretend to believe me."
Her breath caught again, and she leaned forward over her belly. A time passed, and then she told me,
"Bring a basin of warmed water to bathe the child when he comes, and a clean cloth to dry him, a bit of twine to tie the cord tight, a pitcher of cool water, and a cup for me."
And then she curled forward again and let out a long, low moan. And so I went. In the kitchen, I filled a pitcher with hot water from the simmering kettle always kept near the hearth. Around me was the comfortable, familiar clutter of the kitchen at night. The fire muttered to itself. Crocks of dough were slowly rising for the next day's bread. A pot of brown beef stock gave off its fragrant aroma near the back of the hearth.
I found a basin and filled a large mug with cold water. I took a clean cloth from a stack there, found a big tray to put it all on, and loaded it. I stood for a long moment, breathing in the serenity, the sanity of an organized kitchen in a quiet moment. "Oh, Molly," I said to the silent walls. Then I bared my courage as if I were drawing a heavy blade, hefted the tray, balanced it, and set off through the quiet halls of Withywoods. I shouldered the unlatched door open, set the tray down on a table, and walked around to the divan by the fireside. The room smelled of sweat. Molly was silent, her head drooped forward on her chest. After all this, had she fallen asleep sitting in front of the fire? She sat spraddled on the edge of the couch, her nightrobe hiked to her hips. Her cupped hands were between her knees, and the tiniest child I had ever seen rested in her hands. I staggered, nearly fell, and then dropped to my knees, staring. Such a small being, streaked with blood and wax. The baby's eyes were open. My voice shook as I asked, "It's a baby?" She lifted her eyes and stared at me with the tolerance of years. Stupid, beloved man. Even in her exhaustion, she smiled at me. Triumph in that look and love I did not deserve. No rebuke for my doubts. She spoke softly. "Yes. She's our baby. Here at last." The tiny thing was a deep red, with a pale thick umbilical cord coiling from her belly to the afterbirth on the floor at Molly's feet. I choked as I tried to take in a breath. Utter joy collided with deepest shame. I had doubted her. I didn't deserve this miracle. Life would punish me, I was sure of it. My voice sounded childish to me as I begged against all odds, "Is she alive?" Molly sounded exhausted. "She is, but so small. Half the size of a barn cat. Oh, Fitz, how can this be? So long a pregnancy, and so small a child." She took in a shaky breath, refusing tears for practicality. "Bring me the basin of warm water and the soft towels, and something to cut the cord." "Right away." I brought them to her and set them at her feet. The baby still rested in her mother's hands, looking up at her. Molly ran her fingertip across the baby's small mouth, patted her cheek. "You're so still," she said, and her fingers moved to the child's chest. I saw her press them and feel for a heart beating there. Molly looked up at me. "Like a bird's heart," she said. The infant stirred slightly and took a deeper breath. Suddenly she shivered, and Molly held her close to her breast. She looked into the little face as she said, "So tiny. We've waited for you so long. We've waited years. And now you've come, and I doubt that you will stay a day." I wanted to reassure her, but I knew she was right. Molly had begun to tremble with the fatigue of her labor. Still, she was the one to tie the cord and cut it. She leaned down to test the warm water, and then to slide the baby into it. Gently, her hands smoothed the blood away. The tiny skull was coated with downy pale hair. "Her eyes are blue." "All babies are born with blue eyes. They'll change." Molly lifted the baby, and with an easy knack I envied, transferred her from towel to soft white blanket and swaddled her into a tiny bundle, smooth as a moth's cocoon. Molly looked up at me and shook her head at my numb astonishment. "Take her, please. I need to see to myself now." "I might drop her." I was terrified. Molly's solemn gaze met mine. "Take her. Do not put her down. I do not know how long we may have her. Hold her while you can. If she leaves us, she will leave as we are holding her, not alone in her cradle." Her words made the tears course down my cheeks, but I obeyed her, completely meek now in the knowledge of how wrong I had been. I moved to the end of her couch, sat down, and held my new little daughter and looked into her face. Her blue eyes met mine unflinchingly. She did not wail, as I had always believed newborns did. She was utterly calm, and so very still. I met her gaze. She looked to me as if she knew the answer to every mystery. I leaned in closer, taking in her scent, and the wolf in me leapt high. Mine. Suddenly, she was obviously mine in every way. My cub to protect. Mine. From this moment, I would die rather than see harm come to her. Mine. The wit told me that this little spark of life burned strong. Tiny as she was, she would never be prey. I glanced at Molly. She was washing herself. I set a forefinger to my child's brow and very carefully extended my skill toward her. I was not certain of the morality of what I did, but I pushed away all compunction about it. She was too young to ask her permission. I knew clearly what I intended. If I found something wrong with the baby, something physical, I would do whatever I could to mend it, even though it might task my abilities to their limit and might use all the small reserves of strength she had. The child was calm, her blue eyes meeting mine as I probed her. Such a tiny body. I felt her heart pumping her blood, her lungs taking in air. She was tiny, but if there was aught else wrong with her, I could not find it. She squirmed feebly, puckering her tiny mouth as if she would cry, but I was firm. A shadow fell between us. I looked up guiltily. Molly stood over us in a clean, soft robe, already reaching to take the child back from me. As I handed her over, I said quietly, "She's perfect, Molly, inside and out." The baby settled into her embrace, visibly relaxing. Had she resented my skill probe? I looked aside from Molly, ashamed of my ignorance, as I asked, "Is she truly so small for a newborn?" Her words struck me like arrows. "My love, I've never seen a baby this small survive more than an hour." Molly had opened the baby's wrappings and was looking at her. She unfolded the tiny hand and looked at her fingers, stroked the small skull, and then looked at her little red feet. She counted each toe. "But maybe..." "She didn't come early, that's for certain. And every part of her is formed well. She even has hair, though it's so blonde you can barely see it. All my other children were dark, even Nettle." The last she added as if she needed to remind me that I had fathered her first daughter, even if I had not been there to see her born or watch her grow. I needed no such reminder. I nodded and reached out to touch the baby's fist. She pulled it in close to her chest and closed her eyes. I spoke quietly. "My mother was mountain-born," I said quietly. "Both she and my grandmother were fair-haired and blue-eyed. Many of the folk from that region are so. Perhaps I've passed it on to our child." Molly looked startled. I thought it was because I seldom spoke of the mother who had given me up when I was a small child. I no longer denied to myself that I could recall her. She kept her fair hair bound in a single long braid down her back. Her eyes had been blue, her cheekbones high, and her chin narrow. There had never been any rings on her hands. "Kepet," she had named me. When I thought of that distant mountain childhood, it seemed more like a tale I had heard than something that belonged to me. Molly broke into my wandering thoughts. "You say she is perfect, inside and out. Did you use the skill magic to know that?" I looked at her, guiltily aware of how uneasy that magic made her. I lowered my eyes and admitted, "Not only the skill, but the wit tells me that we have a very small, but otherwise healthy child here, my love. The wit tells me the life spark in her is strong and bright. Tiny as she is, I find no reason that she will not live and thrive, and grow." A light kindled in Molly's face, as if I had given her a treasure of inestimable value. I leaned over and traced a soft circle on the babe's cheek. She startled me by turning her face toward my touch, her little lips puckering. "She's hungry," Molly said and laughed aloud. weakly but gratefully. She arranged herself in a chair, opened her robe, and set the babe to her bared breast. I stared at what I had never seen before, moved far past tears. I edged closer to her, knelt beside them on the floor, carefully set my arm around my wife, and looked down at the suckling infant. I've been such an idiot, I said. I should have believed you from the start. Yes, you should have, she agreed. And then she assured me, no harm done, and leaned into my embrace. And that quarrel was ever done between us. Chapter 6 The Secret Child. The hunger for using the skill does not diminish with use or with age. Curiosity disguises itself as a legitimate desire for wisdom and adds its temptation. Only discipline can keep it in check. For this reason, it is best that members of a coterie are kept in proximity to one another throughout the span of their lives, so that they can reinforce with one another the proper use of the skill. It is also vital that journeymen coteries monitor the apprentices, and that masters monitor both journeymen and apprentice coteries. With your solos, be most vigilant of all. Often, solos exhibit an adventurous and arrogant nature, and this is what keeps them from successfully joining a coterie. It is absolutely essential that the skill master be vigilant in overseeing every solo. If a solo becomes secretive and excessively private in his habits, it may be necessary for all masters of the skill to convene and discuss containing his magic, lest it gain control of the solo and he hurt himself or others. But who shall watch over the shepherd? The question presents the problem neatly. The skill master, at his elevated level, can be disciplined only by himself. This is why the position must never be political, nor granted as an honor, but only bestowed to the most learned, the most powerful, and the most disciplined of skill users. When we convened to discuss the abuse of the skill, the horrific damage inflicted on Cowshell Village, and the fall of skill master Clarity, we had to confront what the politicization of this title had done to us all. Unchecked, skill master Clarity entered dreams, influenced thinking, passed judgment on those he considered evil, rewarded his good with advantages in trading, and arranged marriages in this small community, all in an ill-considered attempt to create a harmonious town where jealousy, envy, and excessive ambition were checked for the good of all. Yet we have witnessed what this lofty goal actually created. A village where folk were compelled to act against their own natures, where their emotions could not be expressed, and where ultimately, in a single season, suicides and murders took the lives of more than half the population. In considering the magnitude of the suffering that was created, we can only find fault with ourselves that the master level of skill users remained ignorant of what skill master Clarity was doing until the damage had been done. In order to avoid such a disastrous misuse of the skill in the future, the following actions have been taken. Skill master Clarity is to be sealed from use of the skill in any form henceforth. The selection of a new skillmaster will be made by a process in which the Queen or King suggests 3 candidates from among the masters, and a vote of the masters chooses the new skillmaster. The vote will be done in secrecy, the ballots counted publicly, and the results announced by 3 randomly chosen minstrels dedicated to the truth. This gathering of the masters concludes that no solo must ever hold the rank of skillmaster again. If Clarity had had a coterie of his own, he would have been unable to conceal his actions. Henceforth, the skillmaster shall submit himself to a review of all the masters at least once a year. If he is found incompetent by a vote of the masters, he will be replaced. In extreme cases of abuse or poor judgment, he will be sealed. Compensation and care will be provided to the survivors of the Cowshell Village tragedy. While it cannot be revealed to any of them that the skill was the source of the madness that overtook their village that night, all amends that can be made to them must be made with open-handed generosity and no cessation of such reparation until their natural deaths. Resolution of the Masters following the Cowshell Village tragedy. That first evening that the baby existed outside of Molly's body, I was dazed by her. Long after Molly fell asleep with the baby cradled against her, I sat by the fire and watched them both. I invented 100 futures for her, all of them bright with promise. Molly had told me she was small. I dismissed that concern. All babies were small. She would be fine, and more than fine. She would be clever, this little girl of mine, and lovely. She would dance like thistledown on the wind, and ride as if she were part of her mount. Molly would teach her of bees, and to know the names and properties of every herb in the garden. I would teach her to read and to figure. She would be a prodigy. I imagined her little hands stained with ink as she helped with a transcription, or copied over the illustrations that would never go right for me. I imagined her on the floor of the ballroom at Buckkeep Castle, twirling in a scarlet gown. My heart was full of her, and I wanted the world to celebrate with me. I laughed aloud, ruefully, at how astounded everyone would be to hear of her. Nettle and I had not noised about Molly's claim to be pregnant. We had thought it a sorrow we should keep to ourselves. And now, how foolish we would both look when the word went out that I had a child, a little daughter, fair as a daisy. I imagined a gathering to welcome her to the world. Her brothers would come with their families, and Hap. Oh, that I could somehow send word to the fool of the joy that had come into my life. I smiled to think of it, and longed that it could be so. There would be music and feasting on her naming day. Ketrican, and Dutiful, and his queen, and the princes, even Shade, would make the journey to Withywoods. And with that thought, my elation began to unravel. A child imagined is not the same as a child sleeping in her mother's arms. What would Ketrican and Shade see when they looked at her? I could imagine Shade's skepticism that such a fair-haired child could be of far-seer lineage. And Ketrican, if she recognized that my own mountain mother had likely been fair and acknowledged the babe as the daughter of Fitzchivalry Farseer, what then? What would she think she had the right to ask of my daughter? Would this infant, like Nettle, be seen as a secret reserve of Farseer blood, an heir that could be produced if the recognized line should somehow fail? Trepidation rose in me, a cold tide that drowned my heart in fear. How could I have longed for this child and never considered the dangers that would surround her, simply by virtue of her being my daughter? Shade would want to test her for the skill. Ketrican would believe that the Farseer throne had the right to select a husband for her. I rose and soundlessly paced the room, a wolf guarding his den. Molly slept on, the sleep of exhaustion. The swaddled babe next to her stirred softly and then subsided. I had to protect them, to give the child a future she could determine for herself. My mind swirled with ideas. Flight. We could pack tomorrow and flee. We'd travel to where we could settle as simply Molly and Tom and our baby. No, Molly would never consent to breaking off contact with her other children. Nor could I just walk away from those I loved, no matter what threat they might seem to present right now. So what could I do? I looked at them, sleeping so peacefully, so vulnerable. I would keep them safe, I vowed to myself. It suddenly came to me that the child's fair hair and blue eyes might be in our favor. No one would look at her and assume that she was a natural child of Molly or me. We could claim she was a foundling, taken in. The falsehood blossomed in my mind. So easy to claim. Not even Nettle need know.
Once I had shown Molly the threat to the child, perhaps she would agree to the deception. Nettle would believe we had adopted the babe to placate her mother's longing for an infant. No one need know that she was truly a Farseer. One simple lie could keep her safe. If I could get Molly to agree to it. That night, I went to our room for bedding and took it back down to the nursery. I slept across the door, on the floor, like a wolf guarding his den and cub. It felt right. The next day was filled with both sweetness and trepidation. By the light of dawn, I saw my plans for denying my child as the foolishness it was. The servants in a great house know all, and Revel would immediately know that no foundling had been delivered to us the night before. I could not possibly conceal from the staff that Molly had borne her child, so I warned them that the babe was small and her mother weary. I am sure they considered me quite as mad as they had Molly, as I insisted that I would take Molly's meals into her and that she must absolutely not be disturbed. Not only my veracity as to there being a baby in the house, but my authority as a male in such a female area was instantly dismissed. By ones and twos and threes, the women of the Withywood staff each found some pressing errand that demanded entrance to the nursery. First it was Cook Nutmeg, insisting that she must speak with Molly to know exactly what her mistress would wish to have for her luncheon and supper on such a momentous day. Her daughter Mild slipped in behind her, a slender shadow to her mother's generous figure. Molly had been unaware of my efforts to keep her undisturbed. I could not blame her for a certain starchy smugness as she presented the baby to Cook and her daughter. Molly, I think, was aware only that she was proving them wrong. She had been pregnant, and all their snide dismissal of her insistence that a nursery be prepared was now answered. She was regal as a queen as they advanced to look at the tiny bundle she held so protectively. Cook kept control of herself, smiling at what a dear little thing our baby was. Mild was less schooled to decorum.
"She's so tiny,"
the girl exclaimed.
"Like a doll, and pale as milk. Such blue eyes. Is she blind?"
"Of course not," Molly replied, gazing at her child adoringly. Cook swatted her daughter and hissed,
"Manners!"
"My mother was fair, with blue eyes," I asserted.
"Well, then that explains it,"
Cook Nutmeg asserted, with an unnatural amount of relief. She bobbed a curtsy to Molly.
"Mistress, shall it be the river fish or the salt cod, then? For all know, fish is best for a woman who has just delivered a child."
"River fish, please," Molly replied, and with that vast decision settled, Cook whisked herself and her child from the room. Scarcely had enough time elapsed for Cook to return to her duties before two housemaids presented themselves, asking if the baby or her mother required fresh linens. Each bore an armful, and they all but trampled me as they overran my position in the door, insisting,
"Well, if not now, then soon, for all know how quickly a baby will soil her crib."
And again I witnessed the unnerving spectacle of women barely controlling their shock and then expressing admiration for my daughter. Molly seemed blind to it, but every instinct I had alarmed me. Well I knew how small creatures that were too different were treated. I'd seen crippled chicks pecked to death, witnessed cows that nudged away a weak calf, the runt piglet pushed away from a nipple. I had no reason to think that people were any better than animals in that regard. I would keep watch. Even Revel presented himself, bearing a tray with low vases of flowers on it.
"Winter pansies, so hardy that they bloom through most of the winter in Lady Patience's hothouses. Not that they are truly hot any more. They are not as well tended as they once were."
He rolled a look in my direction, one I steadfastly ignored. And then Molly honored him as she had none of the others. Into his gangly arms, she gave over the tiny bundle of child. I watched him catch his breath as he took her. His long-fingered hands spanned her chest, and a doting smile made foolish his usually somber face. He looked up at Molly. Their eyes met, and I was as close to jealous
as a man could feel to see them share their mutual delight in her. He spoke not a word as he held her, and only gave her back when a housemaid tapped at the door and requested his expertise. Before he left, he carefully arranged each vase of little flowers so that the flowers and the screens echoed one another charmingly. It made Molly smile. That first day of her life, I kept up with the bare minimum of the supervision and work of running the estate. Every moment I could spare, I was in the nursery. I watched Molly and our child, and as I did, my trepidation changed to wonder. The infant was such a tiny entity. Each glimpse of her seemed a wonder. Her tiny fingers, the whirl of pale hair at the back of her neck, the delicate pink of her ears. To me it seemed amazing that such a collection of wondrous parts could simply have grown so secretly inside my lady wife. Surely she was the dedicated work of some magical artist, rather than the chance product of love. When Molly left to bathe, I stayed by her cradle. I watched her breathe. I had no desire to pick her up. She seemed too delicate a creature for me to have in my hands. Like a butterfly, I thought. I feared that with a touch I might damage the shimmer of life that kept her moving. Instead, I watched her sleep, the minuscule rise and fall of the blanket that covered her. Her pink lips moved in and out in sleepy mimicry of nursing.
When her mother returned, I observed them more intently than if she and Molly were players acting out a tale. Molly was as I had never seen her, so calm and competent and focused as a mother.
It healed something in me, a gulf I had never known existed until she filled it. So this was what a mother was. My child was so safe and cared for in her embrace that she had been a mother 7 times before made it seem no less wondrous to me. I wondered, as I must, about the woman who had held and watched me so. A wistful sorrow rose in me as I wondered if that woman still lived, if she knew what had become of me. Did my little daughter's features mirror hers at all? But when I looked at her sleeping profile, I saw only how unique she was. That night, Molly climbed the stairs with me to our bedchamber. She lay down with the swaddled child in the center of the bed, and when I joined them there, I felt as if I formed the other half of a shell around a precious seed. Molly dropped off to sleep immediately, one of her hands resting lightly on our slumbering baby. I lay perfectly still on the edge of the bed, preternaturally aware of the tiny life that rested between us. Slowly, I moved my hand until I could stretch out one of my fingers and touch Molly's hand. Then I closed my eyes and skimmed sleep. I woke when the baby stirred and whimpered. Even without light in the room, I felt how Molly shifted her to put her to the breast. I listened to the small sounds the babe made as she suckled and Molly's deep, slow breathing. Again, I dipped down into sleep. I dreamed. I was a boy again at Buckkeep Castle, and I walked along the top of a stone wall near the herb gardens. It was a warm and sunny spring day. Bees were busy in the fragrant blossoms of a heavy-laden cherry tree that leaned over the wall. I slowed my balancing act as I stepped through the reaching embrace of the pink-petaled branches. Half-concealed there, I froze at the sound of voices. Children were shouting excitedly, obviously in the grip of some competitive game. A longing to join them filled me. But even in the grip of the dream, I knew that was impossible. Within Buckkeep Castle, I was neither meat nor fish. I was too common to seek friends among the well-born, and my illegitimate blood was too noble to allow me to play with the children of the servants. So I listened, keenly envious, and in a moment a small, lithe figure came eeling through the gate to the herb garden, pushing it almost closed behind him. He was a scrawny child, clad all in black save for his white sleeves. A close-fitting black cap confined all but the ends of his pale hair. He went skipping lightly across the garden, hurtling over the herb beds without breaking a leaf to land on a stone path with a near soundless scuff before flinging himself over the next bed. He moved almost in silence, yet his noisy pursuers were not far behind. They flung the gate open with a shout just as he slid behind a climbing rose on a trellis. I held my breath for him. His hiding place was not perfect. Spring was young, and he was a black shadow behind the slender branches and unfurling green leaves of the espaliered rose. A smile bent my mouth as I wondered who would win this game. Other children were spilling into the garden, half a dozen of them. Two girls and four boys, all probably within 3 years of my own age. Their dress revealed them as the children of servants. Two of the older boys were already clad in buckkeep blue tunics and hose, and probably were truant from lesser tasks about the keep.
"Did he come in here?"
one of the girls cried in a shrill voice.
"He had to,"
a boy shouted, but there was a note of uncertainty in his voice. The pursuers spread out quickly, each competing to see who should first spot their quarry. I stood very still, heart beating fast, wondering if they might see me and suddenly include me in their game. Even knowing where the boy hid, I could only just make out his silhouette. His pale fingers gripped the trellis. I could see the very slight rise and fall of his chest that betrayed how long he had been running.
"He went past the gate. Come on!"
one of the elder boys decided, and like a pack of dogs whipped off a fox, the children surged back, milling about him as he led the way back to the gate. Behind them, their prey had turned and was already seeking handholds in the sun-warmed stone wall behind the trellis. I saw him take a step up it, and then a shout from one of the seekers betrayed that someone had glanced back and caught that motion.
"He's there!"
a girl shouted, and the pack raced back into the garden. As the black-clad boy spidered up the tall wall, the children hastily stooped. In an instant, the air was full of flung earth-clods and rocks. They hit the rosebush, the trellis, the wall, and I heard the hollow thuds as they hammered against the slim youth's back. I heard his hoarse gasp of pain, but he kept his grip on the wall and climbed. The game was suddenly not a game at all, but a cruel hunt. Splayed on the wall, he could not seek cover, and as he climbed, the hunters stooped for more rocks and clods. I could have cried out to them to stop, but I knew that if I did, it would not save him. I would simply become an extra target for them. One of the stones hit the back of his head hard enough to snap his head forward against the wall. I heard the slap of flesh on stone and saw how he halted, half stunned, fingers slipping. But he did not cry out again. He shuddered and then began to move more swiftly. His feet slipped, gained purchase, slipped, and then he had a hand on the top of the wall. As if gaining that goal had changed the game, the other children surged forward. He reached the top of the wall, clung there for the bare instant that it took his eyes to meet mine, and then tipped over onto the other side. The blood running down his chin had been shockingly red against his pasty face.
"Go round, go round!"
one of the girls was shrieking, and yelping like hounds the other children turned and poured back out of the garden. I heard the harsh clang of the gate as they flung it closed behind them, and the wild pattering of their feet on the path. They were laughing as they ran. A moment later, I heard a shrill and desperate scream. I woke. I was breathing as harshly as if I'd just fought a bout. My nightshirt was sweated to my chest and twisted about me. Disoriented, I sat up and fought free of the blanket.
"Fitz!"
Molly rebuked me as she flung a sheltering arm over our child.
"What are you thinking?"
Abruptly, I was myself again, a grown man, not a horrified child. I crouched in our bed, next to Molly, next to our tiny baby that I might have crushed in my thrashing. "Did I hurt her?" I cried out in horror, and in response, the baby began a thin wailing. Molly reached across and seized my wrist.
"Fitz, it's all right. You just woke her, that's all. Lie down. It was just a dream."
After all our years together, she was familiar with my nightmares. She knew, to my chagrin, that it could be hazardous to wake me from one.